Edith is one of my first loves as a sort of as a young woman. I was introduced to her thought when I was 15 or 16 in high school, you know, and I just kind of, my husband often says about Aristotle, he says, there are some authors one encounters that one reads just so, and there are other authors that one reads to become to become patterned after, that one discovers along the way that one wants to think like this person. And I think that that's what I thought when I first read Edith. I thought, this is the sort of person that one should get to know very well. So it's been kind of a lifelong passion of mine to read her work. So I was thinking, it is really especially lovely to be speaking about Edith Stein under the auspices of the Thomistic Institute. Edith has an interesting connection to the Dominicans, and I don't know if many of you know this. I don't know how much any of you know about Edith Stein at all, in fact. So I will, I'm happy to take other questions about her life. But she has an interesting connection to the Dominican order. So, though you probably know that Edith was a Carmelite nun before she died, and we think of her as a Carmelite, of course, a Carmelite saint. She, in fact, converted, especially after reading the autobiography of Teresa of Avila. She was at least partly a Dominican in spirit, I think. And I say this for two reasons. First, Edith was possessed of an extraordinary philosophical spirit. So if you haven't, you know, if you haven't spent a lot of time with her, it's kind of remarkable. So many people, I say, study philosophy, right? There's philosophy, they study it. But only a few persons are so philosophical in nature, so devoted to the intellectual life that knowing them, you discover they're pained a little bit to be distracted from the life of the mind. You'd ever had the pleasure of knowing, I mean, some of you may be like that. So these are the people you would call philosophers, right? Not that they study philosophy. So Edith was like this, and this is quite unusual. So after her conversion, she converted in 1921, 22, in the winter. She began to read voraciously in the Catholic tradition. So she's someone who, you know, growing up Jewish and then atheist, didn't read in the Catholic tradition at all. And her philosophical training was completely orthogonal to what we would have thought of as the Catholic tradition. So after her conversion, she began to read widely among Catholic philosophy. She started with the mystics, right? She was reading Teresa of Avila at the time of her conversion, but then she kind of kept moving. She moved systematically then through a lot of Aquinas. And so in this sense, we might claim her for the Dominicans as a kind of kindred sister or daughter of the order in some sense, just her philosophical affinity with the order. But there's another reason to connect Edith with the Dominicans, which is that on account of not holding a university chair, and I'll say more on this in a minute, she spent 12 years teaching at a Dominican secondary school in Speyer. And this school was run by an order of Dominican sisters. And although at this time Edith already harbored kind of hopes about becoming a Carmelite, she was praying about a Carmelite vocation, she spent, you know, 12 years living with these Dominican sisters. And this was not very long after her conversion. So imagine, I was thinking, you know, 12 years is a long time. Daily Mass, Liturgy of the Hours, devotions to Dominican saints, which would have been normal within the school, the Dominican school, all the preaching, the confession, and the spiritual guidance given by Dominican fathers. This is a long time for her in her life, and this was deeply formative for her. You could say that in Speyer, she was sort of born fully into the faith. She learned and absorbed rituals of the liturgical year. One cannot read Edith's writings without being kind of impressed with how often she speaks of the liturgical year and liturgical time in ways that I think are quite uncommon for contemporary Christians or Catholics even. She absorbed all of these things. She became rather habitually Catholic in her time in Speyer. So I think it's kind of impossible to give a fair appraisal of Edith's story without thinking about her connection to the Dominicans. So it was in that time also, incidentally, that she was in Speyer. She was, you know, a teacher. She also used the word formator. She was a formator of girls. It was during this time that she began to think about many of the things that developed into the essays upon which I'm mostly going to comment tonight. So this was important for her. So in that time, she thought a lot about how the ideals, we'll say, of girls' education. And she couldn't think about the ideals of girls' education without thinking, well, you know, we're educating, we think what the object is and what the ideal is, what the goals are, and we can't figure that out unless we figure out what women are supposed to be, right? And is there such a thing as women are supposed to be anything? So she was kind of thinking through these things when she was teaching in Speyer. And these things germinate and eventually form the basis for her several essays and lectures, which are devoted to the education of women. And in fact, many of her most interesting thoughts on women are collected in these lectures on the education of women, right? So she, again, is deeply philosophical. She can't really write about curriculum without expounding on what it is to be a person and what it is to be a woman. So just as a very, very brief, for those of you who don't know anything about Edith, she was born in 1891. To an observant Jewish family, and she was the youngest of 11 children. She renounced her Jewish faith already when she was a fairly young teenager, and this was a great source of suffering for her traditional Jewish mother, who just, you know, her whole life grieved that Edith left the Jewish faith. She was a brilliant student and began to study philosophy first in her hometown in Breslau, but then later at Göttingen with Edmund Husserl, under whom, after she stopped in the First World War, she took a break from her studies and served as a nurse, kind of a Red Cross assistant in World War I. But under Husserl, she wrote a great thesis on empathy. She earns a doctoral degree in 1916, so we're just passing the 100-year anniversary of this, with the highest honors. She then began working as Husserl's assistant, following him to Freiburg, where he moved at that time. And she applied to hold a university chair at Freiburg, but was denied on the grounds that women were not suited to hold university chairs. And then, while still working with Husserl, she completed a second dissertation, which is common in Germany, known as a habilitation. And this was on sentient causality. She was very interested at that time in things that are quite relevant now to the social sciences related to the kind of causality and empiricism. So she wrote the second dissertation in 1918, so this is the 100-year anniversary of that, and was still barred from holding university chair on account of her femininity, in spite of the fact that Husserl thought she was, you know, brilliant. There have been some kind of offbeat rumors about how much she influenced Husserl's work herself, or the extent to which Husserl kind of too much depended upon her, or maybe took advantage of her. Nothing can be really substantiated, but it was an odd sort of relationship. Husserl said something like, Edith Stein should absolutely hold a chair at the university if holding a chair at the university were the sort of thing a woman should do. So it's like very, you know, like he wouldn't use any of his leverage to make it happen. And, you know, I don't think she was particularly, I mean, she was disappointed, but I don't think she was, she wouldn't have described her as a kind of campaigning feminist in any way. This wasn't her style. So she did lecture sometimes in Freiburg. But anyway, it has sometimes been said, surveying her tragic relationship with the academy, that she was barred from the university, from holding a chair at the university, first for being a woman and later for being a Jew. Because later in 1933, years later, she was hoping to hold a teaching position at a small Catholic institute of culture, and she was also not allowed to at this point because she was a Jewish Catholic woman. So what I want to do tonight, then, just to complete our topic, is to give a kind of I'm going to use the language impressionistic account of Edith's view of the soul of a woman. Impressionistic because I'm not going to aim to form a specific argument per se, but what I want to do is try to communicate the essence of her ideas in a way that's kind of faithful to them as much as in spirit and in form. And to do this, I'm going to rely heavily on her own words, in which case you might say, why didn't I get this up on the screen for you? That's okay, you'll have to close your eyes and listen. So to begin with, so I'm going to start to begin... I'm going to kind of enter from broad to narrow. So to begin, think about the term Gestalt. And I'm not a linguist, but for the average Americans, I'll say a few things about this before we move on. So I'm going to quote kind of a hook sentence for us from her Fundamental Principles of Women's Education. So I'm going to say, she says, okay, now that, actually that now is not there, that is an ideal image of the gestalt of the feminine soul. So this is a teaser of sorts. You might want to know what that refers to. And I'm going to spend some time first, however, on this characteristic of her thought, gestalt, which what does she mean there when she says this? But this is important for her thought because you can't really get at her ideas about gender and really not gender fully, but human development without understanding what she means by this. So typically, if you go look for a definition, you're going to find gestalt in English rendered as something like shape or form. And as is the case with many German words, they do not translate perfectly well to anything for us in English. So we have kind of the idea of a shape or a form. But when we say form here, we don't just mean kind of the outline. We do mean something more like the philosophical form or the ideal. So some of you familiar with the philosophical form of a thing. Now, we also, though, have to kind of enlarge this a little bit. We also mean something that's kind of an organizational principle that may be much greater than the sum of the parts, and which may also have the tendency of a tendency. Sorry, the tendency. It may have the characteristic of a tendency. So the gestalt could be more than just the outline of a thing, but something towards which these, you know, parts may be organized and tending. So when I say this, organized and tending, you may have the impression of something moving, and that would be correct, that it's not a static principle or idea, notion. So we take this notion of form, and we complicate it a little bit, this philosophical notion, by thinking about form as regards a thing that is living, right? And then, therefore, changing. So, for instance, we have this typical philosophical difficulties. When we think, here we handy table, we think about the relation between object, say, a table, and its essence, say something like tableness, right? So this already has multiple philosophical difficulties with respect to perception, what we perceive, how we can know things about both the table and its form. I mean, this is all very interesting. But then we have this new level. So now let's think about the same problem with respect to something which is growing. So naturally here, then plants become kind of the next step, right? We've moved beyond tables now as a plant. And this is important reference as we start to think about form with respect to human beings, right? Because human beings are, well, they're more like plants than like tables, right? But there's an infinite chasm, right? So for a plant or a living thing, we have at least the idea that we can think about the plant's growth. We can think about the particular plant. We have, say, like a potted rose in front of us. And we think about the plant, whenever we think about it, we think about it in an instantaneous moment, right? So it's, you know, it's small or it's big or it's just a bud or now the flower has blossomed. We can't easily imagine, nor do we ever, in fact, observe every stage of it, right? This is just what it means to think about growth, development. So the same being, the same living form, right, changes over time. So when we think about the ideal at each stage, when we said there was table and there was tableness, which was something like the form or the gestalt, but there's not a gestalt for the table, right? We think about the form of the table. It's an easier thing to do because the table isn't growing and changing, right? But the plant is growing and changing. So where is the ideal? With respect, or the form, in the sense, with respect to a growing, changing thing. This is a difficult thing. In fact, it's very interesting. Do we think about the ideal for each stage, right? So this rose is kind of an ideal rose because it's, you know, the colors on it now and it's blossomed. Or in fact, is the ideal not merely ideals at each stage, but we think about the process itself as having an ideal. And this becomes very difficult. So continuing in complexity then, we have the human person. So we have all these same difficulties that apply to plant life, but additionally the question of self-direction, self-understanding, meaning, and purpose, right? So now it's not only important to think about these things for sort of abstract philosophical reasons, but Edith, in some ways, although she's going to be very abstract about her thoughts about the human person, but she's going to say, well, you know, in fact, how we think about where we are in the process of development, this isn't sort of irrelevant. These are very important to us. So we not only have to think these things that are complicated about ourselves, but we need to think where we are in respect to the ideals and the process of development. And so this all becomes kind of captured in this notion of the gestalt of the soul. And so all of that is part of this. We're thinking about forms and ideals and a kind of organized shape of things towards which there's a tendency to develop. So this is a complicated thing. It's not merely that there's a table and there's an essence of a table, right? So it's not completely unlike that, but that's the idea. So philosophically, all of this sits as a kind of backdrop when she writes about femininity or masculinity or about people in general and human development. You will find this language. She can't avoid it. She uses it constantly. So I've got some good examples for you. So here's a good example. So here's again from... So I will sometimes tell you where I'm quoting from, but not always because it will get redundant. But just to sort of at the beginning here to drive home the point that she's always speaking with reference to these principles of education. She says, in her essay, Education, she says, just as an inner form resides in the seed of plants, in the seed of a plant, an invisible force, so it's a force, it's a tendency, it's a direction, making a fir tree shoot up here and a beech over there. We then find, too, an inner mold set in human beings which urges evolution in a certain direction. So it's very interesting. So that's, you know, that's just something she's kind of getting to along the way when she thinks about women. And then here's also this. Remember I said this is more complicated, so here she tries to capture this a little bit. She says, what we are trying to do, and this, by the way, this is from an essay on the spirituality of the Christian woman. She said, what we're trying to do is attain insight into the innermost recesses of our being. But we see that it, our own being, is not a completed being, but a being in the state of becoming. And we are trying to achieve clarity relative to that process. So we see that we're developing, we're looking at ourselves, we're developing, we're trying to have some clarity about it. And then she says, our being, our becoming, does not remain enclosed within its own confines, but rather in extending itself out, fulfills itself. However, all of our being and becoming and acting in time is ordered from eternity and has a meaning for eternity and only becomes clear to us insofar as we put it in light of eternity. This is very classic, Edith. Someone asked me beforehand why Edith's thought has not been taken up more by feminists. And the main reason is because she's too deeply religious. And you can't get into her thoughts on women without kind of, you know, she'll start to tell you about the importance of Eucharistic life for balancing work and family, for instance. I mean, what are you going to do with that if you're writing on feminism in 1930, right? So this is very classic for her. But again, this kind of, okay, so insight into this innermost being, but this is a process of being and becoming. And those of you who are philosophical or are interested in philosophical ideas, a lot of this language of the Gestalt and this kind of being and becoming is coming from her training in the phenomenological tradition. So there's lots more to study there. So here's another example from the text on spirituality. She says, we always will find fundamentally the compulsion to become what the soul should be, the drive to allow the latent humanity. So by latent, she means something like this inner form that's sitting in the seed. The inner humanity that's latent, set precisely in its individual stamp, so she has an idea of individualized humanity, to ripen to the greatest possible development. So the language of fruit, right, is ripening. So there's a fruit, there's a plant. You always find this kind of... but then there's this drive, and then, of course, she's going to get into later the idea that, of course, you can fail to develop the soul, this soul stuff can fail to develop if we don't direct it. So it's possible to kind of be an undeveloped soul. So for Edith, the human soul has a kind of gestalt, and by this we could kind of substitute something like what the soul ought to be, or what it should be. She will sometimes use that language. And this gestalt, if you will, is both a goal, but it's also a process that incorporates a drive or a kind of compulsion or a tendency. And we can't disrupt these tendencies or these compulsions without doing a kind of violence to nature. And these are all sort of fascinating concepts in themselves, and they're not for the rest of tonight. Each of them, though, could be developed with respect to what we might call nature, and this is a very interesting question. Too much for tonight. But this is just to give you a sense. What I'm gonna try to do now is like fill in what does she mean by this, the feminine gestalt, and is there a masculine gestalt too? There is. So I'm going to fill all of this in for you. But that I think that might help a little bit, that this notion of gestalt is really interesting and rich, and frankly, at least in her thought, has not been paid attention to. So all of you people looking for, I don't know, thesis topics or research topics, a lot here. So, okay, so in the second part here, before I move into finally what the feminine gestalt is like, I'm gonna just stop at one more point here. I began by quoting this sentence that is an ideal image of the gestalt of the feminine soul. And I promised we would go towards what that is, but here's one more sort of stop along the way. So I need to stop, and we've talked about kind of human development and the soul a little bit more. I want to say that on the matter of femininity or masculinity, she has a kind of refined taxonomy, which is completely sensible given who she was and where she was in time. But it's worth making it clear. This taxonomy emerges as a kind of threefold schema when she's talking about human development and personal identity. So in the first, we have a kind of universal human nature to which everyone belongs, and the end of which, males and females, and the end of which is perfection and sanctification. So this is the top level. And then we have this second level, which is, I think for lack of a better word, we could just call it gender identity. But she doesn't use that term. I'm kind of using that term. So this would be male and female sexual difference. And for Edith, these male and female, the traits, the aspects, and this is where you see that once we've defined gestalt and the way we've defined or thought about it and posited that there would be a feminine gestalt and a masculine, I mean, it's almost more, I almost don't need to say that, of course, for her, she thinks of these things as kind of essential, like they're essential to the person. And by that, I mean, you know, philosophically so, not accidental. Now, she sometimes even, she sees this male and female within the general human nature as so distinct and so so fixed that she often uses the philosophical term species to call them separate species. So the male species and the, I know that sounds a little odd to your ear, but she does that. Now, then within that, she gives a great deal of play. So before you worry, she gives a great deal of play to the third level, which she calls individual variation. She's going to call these types. So we have, you know, so we've got, you know, human beings, we have males and females, and then we have types of males and females within that. And so right when you get there, she's very quickly going to tell you, now it's the case that once you get into individual variation, many individuals who are males and females may have traits which look more feminine or more masculine, and that's perfectly fine, she said. It's hard to resist the notion or the idea that one of the reasons she says this is she thinks a lot about it, and she thinks of herself as having many masculine traits, actually. So this is a kind of interesting feature. Most of her close friends in life were men. So she says that these types, you could call them personalities, individual predispositions and gifts and specific loves, and she speaks a lot about this. She says, for instance, it's not possible, I'm quoting her, not possible to generalize about individuality as one might generalize about perfected humanity, remember the first category, or perfected womanhood. So she says, in the first two, in this threefold schema, we can generalize. But when we get to individuality, forget about it, right? Everybody is just a unique individual in that sense. There's no generalizing. So I'm going to make three brief comments about her view of gender in general, and then we'll move on to the specifically feminine. So first, for her, this is the second piece of the schema, right? So for her, while gender identity is complex, it is not wholly obscured from discovery, right? So you might say, well, all right, you know, this is complicated. Now we've got human beings, we've got males and females, and we've got this pretty well-defined view of individual nature. So like, really, how much could you get out of the male and female category? Like, could you really get it? Could you pull something out of it that we could know? But she's pretty clear about this, and she's not unaware. Many of her contemporaries are saying that you can't know these things. In fact, many coming before her. In fact, I've got at least, yeah. I mean, John Stuart Mill, of course, comes before Edith Stein. He's absolutely convinced you can't tell anything about men and women. So she says the calling or the identity of men and women may be discovered in the words, like where would you find this out? In the words of Old and New Testament. It is inscribed in the nature of man and woman. History then elucidates this for us, so we can learn from history about what it means to be a man or a woman. Then she says, finally, the needs of our time declare a kind of urgent message that, in other words, we need to kind of say what this is. She's actually very worried about a bunch of things happening in social life in Germany at that time. She says, although it's a diversely fibered texture, the design is not so complex that a few clear lines would not emerge. So she says, we may therefore on these grounds attempt to answer the question to what are men and women called. So she actually kind of wants to make the case. When she goes out and lectures, she lectures a lot on the nature and vocation of men and women. She wants to make the case that it's possible to know something, right? She's going to get that straight first. So she appeals to the religious tradition of Judaism and Christianity as a source for knowing something about what it means to be a woman or a man. She also appeals to history and to culture. And I just thought for fun it would be worth contrasting this view with Mill's skepticism. So if you've read John Stuart Mill's On the Subjection of Women, my favorite line in that text is this one. And Mill is always dramatic and kind of obnoxious, but he says, John Stuart Mill says, standing on the ground of common sense and the constitution of the human mind, I deny that anyone knows or can know the nature of the two sexes. And then he goes on. I mean, there's a qualifier there. He says the nature of the two sexes, so far as they've been sort of distorted in reality by the subjection of women to their masters. And then he moves on. He says, in fact, I would go so far as to say no class of slaves has been so distorted by the relation with their masters as women to men. You know, it's classic Mill. But it's worth noting. I mean, he doesn't write this very long before Edith is writing. So it's kind of worth noting the very different proposition with respect to what we can know about what it means to be a man and a woman, right? So Mill says, let's just throw it all out. Not sure we can know anything. And Edith says, no, we can know some things. And here are the reasons, right? Here are the orders of reality with which we can, on which we can ground this material. Okay, so the second comment is this. For Edith, in her thought, right, there's a real and discernible, so we're discerning it, natural difference between men and women, what I've kind of playfully called the gender identity. And this constitutes a difference which is essential to the person. So the essentialism there is kind of worth highlighting. So it's pretty profound for Edith. For Edith Stein, equality, then, is not an ideal when speaking of the genders because it's simply factually false. We're just not equal. So why would it be a goal? We're just not equal. I can only treat this point briefly, but I want to, again, mostly I just want to introduce you to her thought. So I've got a lot of great quotes. So you can enter into the spirit of her thought in the following quote. She says, only the person blinded by controversy could deny that woman in soul and body is formed for a particular purpose. And then she goes on, the clear and irrevocable word of scripture and daily experience, and she kind of has, et cetera, et cetera, it's a long quote, declares what experience teaches us from the beginning of the world, that woman is destined to be wife and mother. Both physically and spiritually, she's endowed for this purpose, as is clearly seen from practical experience. However, so this is important, however, she says, it follows from the Thomistic principle, anima forma corporis, that such a spiritual characteristic of womanhood, motherhood, does exist. She says, of course, woman shares a basic human nature with men, but basically her faculties are different from men. Therefore, a differing type of soul must exist as well. So this is very gender essentialist in its flavor, if you will, right? In fact, I was giving a different talk on gender recently, and someone in the audience with whom I share a great deal of intellectual similarity said, you know, I really think it's not helpful to the discourse today to really emphasize how different men and women are. Because what I find is I've got to urge my students to realize that, like, if they're going to ever date anybody or form a successful marriage, they have to not view the other gender as, like, completely different from them. I said, I don't know what's helpful or not helpful, but what's true, you know? It's very, you know. And then he handed me his book on getting married, which I don't think very highly of, but it's okay. It's all right. He's a great guy. So anyway, so this is very gender essentialist in its characteristic. Now, I don't think who read a lot of the feminist literature, you wouldn't want to pigeonhole Edith Stein as a gender essentialist. She's got a lot more to her than that. But if you had to put her on the spectrum someplace, right, she's pretty far on the essentialist side. So we can see in this quote that I just read to you, which I didn't want to read the whole quote to you because it kind of gives away the next part of the talk a little bit. But you can see what she says there. First, first something that is one of the notes of her thought, which is just her strength of mind. So she starts out, only the person blinded by controversy, right? You know, like in other words, only if you're mad. Only if you're mad would you sort of want to really disagree with this. Second, her very strong sense of the order of reality, right? What is material for Edith? So the corporis, it just doesn't give rise to anything. This is very important domestic principle. What's material doesn't give rise to anything. It's dead, right? Matter is dead. Instead, spirit or anima is what gives form, shape, gestalt to the matter, and we must understand the spirit to be solely determinative. Right? So the matter doesn't determine anything. Only, you know, and this gives you this kind of problem, right? It's something that another interesting question is kind of how Edith's thought on gender relates to Thomas's thought. I'm working on that, and about, you know, four other people are working on that. The easiest thing you could say about Thomas is he just didn't care very much about this. It wasn't really a, you know. So I think we can. There's a way to make sense out of these two things, and they, I think they're complementary. I can say more about that later. But mostly, you know, Thomas didn't care very much, and he didn't treat it directly. There was always examples that were replies to objections for other reasons. You know, he's talking about angels, and he has an example with women, so it wasn't a big concern of his. Edith loved Thomas's thought, and so she really draws a lot from him when she's developing this theory. So spirit is what is determinative for her. So this is, I guess, her strong sense of the order of reality. We would use that language in Thomistic work. So here's another example of this kind of spirit from a completely separate work that she wrote called Finite and Eternal Being, one of the last things that she wrote when she was in Carmel. She said, it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful thought altogether. It's very, very brief. If humans rank above lower creatures because as spirit they imitate God, their generative power, right? Their generative power, which refers to our sexual difference, also must be rooted in the spirit. But really, it's a beautiful and very interesting thought you could reflect on. So her inquiries into gender sort of ipso facto become journeys into the investigation of gendered spirit or gendered soul. You know, this raises all kinds of interesting problems which are not yet resolved. But you can't, in Edith's language, you cannot entertain the idea that bodies of men and women are anything other than kind of shadowy reflections of the soul. Right? So we tend to think of the body as what's really more visible, but she's sort of, no, actually that's kind of shadowy. And that's, you know, it's hard to think that she's not tracking Teresa of Avila very closely there, right, who is the beginning of her Catholic journey. But she reads Teresa of Avila. So the mystics will say this all the time, right, that real reality, not this reality, but real reality is so much more real once you've seen a little bit of it. You come back, right? So if you're, you know, through contemplation or a spiritual gift, you have the gift of seeing something, a spiritual reality that we don't ordinarily see. When you come back to life, regular life, this all looks kind of dull and colorless. But we imagine it would be the other way around. We imagine, what could heaven be like? Like, it's sort of always a little flat in my imagination. And, like, could it really be that exciting? Could it be as good as, I don't know, my favorite places on earth? But the saints who go there come back and they say, no, actually, like, if you... So this is the way to think about her view of the feminine soul, the feminine spirit, and the masculine spirit, that there's a kind of... These are, like, vital forces. These have kind of a vital reality. And the colorful reality of a masculine soul or the feminine soul is so much more real and determinative in a certain sense than the bodies that we see, even though we do see differences in our bodies and similarities. So I kind of wanted to impress that upon you before I moved on. Okay. So this, I think, sets us up quite nicely for thinking about the gestalt of the feminine soul. So I want to start first by reading to you from what comes before the key sentence. That is an ideal image of the gestalt. So this is one of her most famous, most often quoted. She's got a number of things, but this is very, very often quoted. It'll take me a minute to read it. She says, the soul of a woman must therefore be expansive, I need like a whiteboard now, expansive and open to all human beings. It must be quiet, so that no small, weak flame would be extinguished by stormy winds. It must be warm, so as not to benumb fragile buds. Notice the language of the plants again. The little buds are in there. And the soul must be warm, so the buds don't kind of die before they blossom. It should be clear, so that no vermin would settle in dark corners and recesses. That is definitely a Tresian image coming from the interior castle. It must be self-contained, so that no invasions from without could peril the inner lift. It must be empty of itself in order that extraneous life may have room in it. And finally, the soul of a woman must be mistress of itself and also of its body. So master of itself, mistress of itself. So that the entire person is readily at the disposal of every call, right? So that you're not called upon and you think, well, someone needs me. And you kind of think, well, yeah, but I can't get off the couch. you got to be in charge of yourself to be able to respond. She says, she often speaks about she uses the language of self-discipline, a disciplined body, she says. She uses this a lot. Now, after all of what I just read to you, she says, now that is an ideal image of the gestalt of the feminine soul. Then she says, and this is, you see the problem with the feminists, right? Immediately after that, like they're never separated for her. Immediately after that, she says, the soul of the first woman, so Eve, was formed for this purpose. And so too was the soul of the Mother of God. In all other women since the fall, in other words, in all other women except Mary, there is an embryo of such development. Again, these organic images. There is an embryo of such development of the soul. In other words, all the women since Eve, we have an embryo of this ideal image of what the soul should be like. But it needs cultivation. Again, the organic language, like the gardener, it needs cultivation or we're not going to get there. If it's not going to be suffocated among the weeds shooting up around it. So in other words, you know, we're all lucky to have an embryonic bit of this kind of gestalt. But then there's all this development that needs to take place. Of course, for her, this is coming right out of the principles of women's education. So now she's going to go on to tell us, if we want to cultivate that in young women, what would we do? What would education look like? What would they read? Who would be with them? What would we try to teach them? What would that look like? So, you know, she's going to get that all described before she gets to the outline of the curriculum. So let's cover some of the key points, again, mostly in her own words, about this gestalt. So we've got these characteristics, which I should have put up on the board for you. So the first one, which I've already read to you, but I've got more quotes, is that the original vocation of woman is to be spouse and mother. So, you know, we're not dealing with someone who has a simplistic view of things, and I'm going to expand on this in a little bit, but the best thing is just to sort of see that this is what she believes. So along the way, I'll kind of draw the comparison. What does she think the gestalt of the male soul is like, and why are these things different? How do they complement each other? So she says, for instance, I think, now I'm wondering if I read this one already, but in the same one, she says that the soul always fundamentally is compelled to become what it should be, that latent humanity. I think I did read that to you. Set precisely in its individual stamp is going to ripen. Okay, immediately after that, what does she say? The deepest feminine yearning is to achieve a loving union which, in its development, validates this maturation and simultaneously stimulates and furthers the desire for perfection in others. Such a yearning is an essential aspect of the eternal destiny of women. So what is she saying? She's saying that fundamentally, the destination, that actually was not an uncommon use of the term destination as vocation, the destination of woman was espousal and maternal. So what the soul should be is spousal. So what does she mean by spousal? Well, she says to form a loving union, which in its development validates this maturation. So why is this particularly feminine? Is not the male also fashioned for this purpose? And she has an interesting take on that, which I'll kind of hint at now, but I'll read more later. What I am saying now, she does want to say is specifically feminine. she'll say in another text altogether, the deepest longing of a woman's heart is to give herself lovingly to another, to belong to another, to possess another being completely. In fact, she has a lot of really interesting discourses where she goes through works of great literature and talks about the kind of perversions we see in women, like badly formed women, women behaving badly, who become bad, particularly by kind of developing or giving free rein to these tendencies, which she'll say, well, this is very feminine to want to possess the beloved completely and to be zero, to be very jealous and to be, right, to go after with a single-mindedness. And then she says, but, you know, ready, this is how you get these other bad things. So kind of interesting. She says, to possess the other being completely, this longing is revealed in her outlook, which is personal and all-embracing and appears to us as specifically feminine. So in another text, she says, woman's nature is determined by her original vocation. Now, those of you who have read the work of John Paul II will remember this language of original vocation. John Paul was influenced by Edith's language in that respect. So this is coming from her. The original vocation of spouse and mother. One depends upon the other, she says. So for Edith, it's always awkward, actually. So she'll say, well, the fundamental vocation of woman, she can't stop at spouse. Right, because you can't. That can't be the only thing. It has to be spouse and mother. It's always spouse and mother, so it's always a little awkward. She says, the body of a woman is fashioned to be one flesh with another and to nurse new human life in itself. A well-disciplined body, remember I said she talks about discipline of the body, a well-disciplined body is an accommodating instrument for the mind which animates it, and at the same time, it is a source of power and a habitat for the mind. Just so, woman's soul is designed to be subordinate to man in obedience and support. It is also fashioned to be a shelter, so this becomes a very important image for her, a shelter in which other souls may unfold. So that, for her, right, what I just said, shelter in which other souls may unfold, that's more or less her definition of motherhood, which is why, of course, in a minute, you know, you'll see that when she's developing this idea about what it is to be feminine, she's not limiting this, of course, to physical motherhood. She's sort of saying, like, if whatever a woman is doing anywhere, what she tends toward is this thing, right? This is gestalt. She tends towards doing this. In fact, so you find women wherever they pop up, if they're really feminine, they do this thing. They kind of, like, take people under their shelter. And they want to know what people need, and they want to think about where they're going, and they tend to kind of assist people, persons, and their projects towards their development. They're, she will often say, they're almost divinely ordained to the task of assistance. In another place, she talks about actually helping the personality of the personality to develop, to unfold. And again, that's another thing that comes out in John Paul II's Dignitatis Mulier. He talks a lot about the way that women kind of, he doesn't use this language, capture, but enfold and shelter other persons and personalities and sort of assist them in becoming whole. So she's got this all kind of in there. So it's fashioned to be a shelter in which other souls may unfold. Both spiritual companionship and spiritual motherliness, so there when she says spiritual companionship, she really means, you know, spousalness, are not limited to the physical spouse and mother relationships, but they extend, of course, to all people with whom woman comes into contact. Okay, so we've already got this. We've got this laid out, and then the second point. We've got spouse and mother, and I'll contrast that with the masculine to give you the full picture in a minute. So there's another piece, and this is the piece where like the strict Thomists get very uncomfortable. Are you ready? Or do we have any strict Thomists? I don't have Father Legge isn't here. I'm still convinced this is we can work this out, but this is the place where the Thomists get very uncomfortable. But it's just lovely. I mean, I don't know anyone else who writes and thinks about gender in such a way that you read it and you think, this really, yeah, she's got that right. And then you think, well, we'll get the details of the philosophy at some point, but this is right? This seems to me to be right. She says, I would also like to believe, this isn't a separate part, sorry, this is my second point. So we have spouse and mother. The second point is that there's a special unity. The feminine soul, part of the gestalt of the feminine soul is a special kind of unity in the person, or kind of integration of the person. And she thinks this is not the same for men and women. So she says, and you see, she's hedging, remember the strength of mind, she hedges. I would also like to believe, she says. She doesn't come down and say, I believe. She says, I would like to believe. that the relationship between soul and body is not completely similar in man and woman. With woman, she says, the soul's union with the body is naturally more intimately emphasized. So women are more like in their bodies. This is what she's kind of trying to get at. Woman's soul is present and lives more intensely in all parts of the body. And it, the soul, is inwardly affected by that which happens to the body more intensely. She says, whereas with men, the body has a pronouncedly the character of an instrument. It's very interesting. Kind of a tool, right? Which serves them in their work and which is accompanied by a certain kind of detachment. So this is very interesting. I mean, I have six sons, boys when they're young. I mean, they kind of throw their body at things as if they're right all the time. And there's a kind of, they possess a kind of natural willingness to be detached from not only their bodies, but the consequences to their bodies of reckless actions that it's just not common in young women. So it's amazing. So she really captures that so nicely. You know, whether that thing that's different is really a difference in the relation between the soul and the body, or if it's something else, we could debate about that. But this is a true thing, right? So she says, well, that difference in the kind of personal integration. I mean, look, obviously men have to be able to do this. It's a wonderful thing that they can do this, right? Because otherwise no one goes to war, no one, like, does a risky job. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's just great that men can dispose of their bodies in the way that they do. But she says, on the feminine side, the fact that we're kind of, like, really in our bodies and we're really attuned to what's happening in our bodies and we care a lot about what's happening in our bodies, right? This is very feminine. And it can obviously get taken to a ridiculous extreme, and it does, right? She says, well, that is closely related to the vocation of motherhood, right? So if you're going to welcome a conceived human person in all of its entirety inside of your body, you would better darn well be, like, pretty interested in living in your body, right? And pretty uninterested in disposing of your body like it's a tool, right? I mean, so this is pretty sensible to me. So she says then, in relation to this, she says, the task of assimilating in oneself another living being, which is itself evolving and growing, of containing it and nourishing it, this process of formation, mysterious, of a new creature inside the maternal organism, represents such an intimate unity of the physical and the spiritual that one is well able to understand that this unity imposes itself on the entire nature of woman. So for her, like, the idea that a woman would be sort of a biological, you know, incubation, like, that's not... She's like, the thing that you're doing when you are harboring and nurturing this human being is so determined by this, not just the physical capacity of the woman, but also her spiritual capacities, that this unity imposes itself on the whole nature of woman. So she thinks that there's a special, women tend toward and prefer a kind of unity of life, a kind of integration of all the things in their lives, that is distinct from the way in which men tend to approach and take joy in life. So this is interesting. And then a final point on this, she says, a quality that is unique to woman is her singular sensitivity to moral virtues and an abhorrence for all which is low and mean. Allied closely to this sensitivity for moral values is her yearning for the divine and for her own personal union with the Lord. So I'm going to develop this in a little bit more later, but she thinks that this kind of unity that women has gives them both a kind of special right or a special gift, but also a duty. So she actually thinks, and I guess I'll move now to the third kind of characteristic, which is the spiritual powers that women have. So she thinks that, well, because we have this unity and this, we also have this special tendency, right? Part of the gestalt is a special tendency towards union with persons, that women are specially gifted in the spiritual life in some sense. But what she wants to say is that it's a kind of gift, but it's also a kind of responsibility. Like, it's got some grave responsibility, we'll say. Because then she's going to say, well, look, since women naturally tend toward and want union with the beloved, they will find it if they're not distorted, she'll say. If they're not distorted from their natural purpose, they will be naturally inclined to religious things, and they will naturally want to grow in the spiritual life. And then she will say, in fact, this is so important for women that if they don't do this, they're actually really not going to they're really not going to fulfill themselves. They're really not going to fulfill their mission in life. So they're really going to fall short. Like, they're going to be very deformed women. And so she's pretty strict on this. So again, you see, like, this is why she's not picked up by the feminists, right? She's not picked up by the feminists. So she's very, and she'll say that this is, like, less, it's not less, so the whole path, the spiritual path is very different for men, for her, in her view. So it's kind of interesting. So in other words, special talents, in some sense, for the spiritual life that women have, but also special responsibility, right? You never get those two things separate. So here's other examples of her language about the spiritual powers of women. She'll say, in the spirituality of the Christian woman, a woman can achieve perfect development of her personality only by activating her spiritual powers. If she remains what the language I like to use, which is sort of more from Catherine of Siena, a spiritual brute. Okay, they're spiritual brutes. If women remain spiritual brutes, they will not achieve the development of their person. So what is a spiritual brute? A brute is something where, you know, the way to think about a brute is something that's asymmetrically developed, right? So, like, I don't know, if I played a sport that I used this arm all the time and not this one, and this arm was, like, really bright, then this would be brutish. But what we should really think about is, like, developing the body and not the soul, right? And there's a whole bunch of ways we can think about that. She says, for instance, the strength of women lies in the emotional life, and then this feeds into the spiritual life. In a separate place, she says, woman naturally seeks to embrace that which is living, personal, and whole. To cherish, guard, protect, nourish, and advance growth is her natural maternal yearning. And then she says, woman can become what she could be, what she should become, in conformity with her primary vocation, only when formation through grace accompanies the natural inner formation. Because of this, I mean, this is really pretty stark. Because of this, religious education must be the core of all women's education. It's like there's just, in her view, like if you're going to even start to do education of women without religion, you should just give up. Just not bother. This is very strong for her. Okay, so what about, this sounds very, I don't know, old-fashioned or traditional or something. Does she mean that all the women should kind of get married and, like, have kids and stay home? No, she doesn't really think that. Remember, she was a single woman who did two doctorates and was an assistant for a famous philosopher most of her life until she taught in a school only because she couldn't teach at a university. So what did she think about that? Well, she said basically that I'll quote from her directly. She said, every profession in which woman's soul comes into its own and which can be formed by woman's soul is an authentic woman's profession. She in another place she says there's no real human activity that women should not be able to do or that women should be legally barred from doing. So she thought women should do everything and could do everything. But then she said something like that women could form the profession or their own professional work in their own particular way, and that they tended to do this when they were not, again, deformed themselves. Now, she did think that if one were to be married and have children, and again, she was a single woman most of her life and then became a religious contemplative sister, she thought that was the better vocation, certainly, and I've got lots of quotes to back that up. But she also thought, well, if you did get married and have children, again, she didn't really think it was a problem if you had a job or you worked. She said, for instance, and I'm quoting, we should accept as normal that the married woman is restricted to domestic life. And by restricted, she didn't mean, like, by law. She just meant, you know, that would be normal. Restricted herself to domestic life at a time when her household duties exact her total energies. She said, any social condition is an unhealthy one, which compels married women to seek gainful employment and makes it impossible for them to manage their homes without kind of tacking on all kinds of extra stuff, like to pay the bills. So she thought that was, you know, you should have to view that as unjust. But then in other places she describes, you know, kind of, she uses the language of heroic. She says, but there are heroic women who, you know, have to do these things, and they seek solace in the Lord, and they have a healthy liturgical life, and they find a way to carry the burden of two burdens. So she has this great quote. She says, many of the best women are almost overwhelmed by the double burden of family duties and professional life. are often simply not even professional life, but just gainful employment. Always on the go, they're harassed and nervous and irritable. And she goes on to describe what that could look like if it were done better. But I was always, I've struck by this double burden language. So the people familiar with the contemporary debate about women and work, this language of second shift, right? That women go to work and then they work another shift when they come home because they inordinately carry the burdens of the home. So here she is in 1930 talking about the second shift. But her thoughts on women and work are kind of interesting and well developed, and she's not doctrinaire about anything, you know, except the things that really matter, which is kind of interesting. So moving on, because I want to get to the gestalt of the masculine before I wrap up. On women and the church, she has lovely, lovely writings on women and the church. So women are called upon to embody women in their highest and purest development. So what are women tending towards, that gestalt? Where are we going with all of that maternal sheltering? And she says, well, we are called to embody in our highest and purest development the essence of the church, to be the symbol of the church. So that's where we're going. That's the point here. She says about Genesis, she's kind of commenting on Genesis, the creation of Eve from the rib of the first Adam becomes a prefigurement for the emergence of the new Eve, right, Mary. And then she says, by that is meant Mary, but at the same time also the whole church opened from the side of the new Adam, so also every woman, insofar as she manages to conform herself to this goal. So she also says, for instance, we may consider the church as a supernatural mother, of whom woman is an essential organ. So she has a very lively and interesting thought on women in the church. She says each woman, again, you and me, if we're not deforming ourselves, stands at his side, like the church, and assists Christ in his work of redemption as its like its prototype, like the mother of God, in whom the church has its origin. The complete surrender of her entire life and being is to live and work with Christ. But that means also to suffer and die with him, that fruitful death from which the life of grace springs for all humanity. So it's very, very rich and interesting. So just to wrap up, I wanted to, I think, like 5 more minutes, I think, time-wise. Is that good? Okay. Yeah, 5 or 6. I'll finish by kind of wrapping a little bit of interest around this gestalt of the masculine, because there can't be a gestalt of the feminine without one of the masculine. And she doesn't write very much on the gestalt of the masculine except by suggestion. And that's not because she wasn't interested in it as much, but because she was frequently called upon to write about women's questions. So most of the stuff that I'm quoting from came from lectures that she gave. She was known to be a great speaker and thinker. And at that time in Germany, this is, you know, between the wars, there was a lot of interest in these questions. There were a lot of women's groups and women's, you know, sodalities and women's stuff. And she was getting invited to a lot of these things. She was a little bit of for a little space of time, she was a little mini celebrity on these questions. And so she would go and give these talks. And the talks themselves are kind of funny because you often find her, I may have one example here, you often find her kind of mildly criticizing the groups that she's addressing. Not harshly, but she'll say, so here's an example. She says, when she's talking about this one talk she has on the ethos of women's professions, she says, look, you know, at the end of the day, everything can be a women's profession. It has to have these marks of the feminine, these, you know, the things we've talked about. And then she says, but why in this conference that you organized was there a need for a special category of women's professions? Why are there such frequent discussions in women's professions, she says, and hardly any on men's professions? And she kind of goes on, it's clear that she has a little bit of impatience with something like intellectual weakness. She finds a little impatient, you know. She's got these gatherings of like clucky women that are all, when they want to hear her talk about women, and they think she's a superstar, and she's kind of like, come on, people, like, you know, was it, you know, it's a big deal, like. Just go be women, and she's a little bit of this thing. So it's kind of nice to see that. All right. So what about the male gender identity or the male sort of spot in that threefold hierarchy? So Edith describes the essence of the male identity as the call to be the master of the created world. that his body and soul, remember the body and soul of the woman were created for a particular purpose, and only the person blinded by controversy could deny it. She says of the man that his body and soul are equipped to fight and conquer it, the world, to understand it, and by knowledge to make it his own, to possess it and to enjoy it, and finally to make it, in a sense, his own creation through purposeful activity. So she calls this kingship and lordship, and she's careful to describe the ways in which fallen human nature frequently perverts the male identity into a kind of visible tyranny, a kind of lording it over, so lordship becomes lording it over. But, by the way, she spends equal amounts of ink on all the ways in which women get off the rails, and she's very clear about this. So she's not picking on the men here. But she calls this kingship and lordship. So she says, for instance, man's essential desires reveal themselves in action, work, and objective achievements. So, in other words, this is meant as a contrast to the woman's essential longing, which is to achieve loving union, right, and motherhood, right? So very different. And I'm gonna kind of mix up these quotes for a minute. So what about fatherhood for men, right? So what is this? So as best I can make out, I'm going to just try to give you a plain representation of what she wrote. As best I can make out, what we see is a kind of asymmetry between the genders for her, which is a little bit interesting. So men become fathers through the kingly vocation. So the kingly vocation for the man is to sort of become master of the created world, to take a piece of the created world that might be his, to kind of like fight it, to conquer it, to master it. And they become fathers by participation in this kingly vocation. So they, in some sense, they take a wife and they make her fruitful. So this is strange for us now, but they take a wife, and this is like they take a piece of land and they make that fruitful, and they take a wife and they make her fruitful. This is the fatherhood, the fatherly part of their vocation is subsumed under the kingly part of the vocation. Okay, so women, so like watch these sort of asymmetry. Women participate also, right, when we were all called to priest, prophet, and king. Women, she says, participate also in the kingly vocation, but as queens, right? But how? She says, well, actually by virtue of becoming wives and mothers. So sort of the men are kind of kings, right? And then they do this activity, which has various forms. And one of these forms, and perhaps maybe it's the primary form, she doesn't say, but one of these forms is the taking of a spouse and making her fruitful. For women, they come to have authority over other people in the manner of a king, which we would call a queen. They come to have authority over other people in that manner by becoming spouses of kings, by becoming spouses of mothers. So the motherhood, in some sense, the acquisition to motherhood grants women the kind of queenly authority to which they are called, but it's after the other piece. So it's so motherhood or spousal motherhood is primary, and then queenship comes as a result. Whereas for men, kingship is primary, and fatherhood comes as a result. And it's kind of a subtle difference, but it's certainly there in her text. And make of it what you want. It's interesting. I'll just then conclude by reading a little bit more about from this last bit about men, but where she rounds it out with the women, and then we'll do some questions. She says, I already started with this one. Men's essential desires reveal themselves in action, work, and objective achievements. He, men, is less concerned with problems of being, whether his own or others. Certainly, being and doing cannot be wholly separated. The human soul, is not a complete, static, unchanging, monolithic existence. So again, this is growing and becoming. She says, it is in the state of becoming, in the process of becoming. Then the soul must bring to fruition these predispositions with which it was endowed when it was coming into the world. However, it can develop them only through activation. So she, like, how do you activate your spiritual powers? She says, women can achieve perfect development of her personality only by activating her spiritual powers. If she doesn't, she's dead in the water. And she says, so do men also activate their spiritual powers. But how so? Even without realizing it as a goal, they do this through their work, she says, when they endeavor to perform things objectively. And this is a kind of tenet, they tend in the manner of their objective work to develop their personality, like, fully. Right? Remember, the women could do this through motherhood and through spiritual development. And then she says at the end, in both instances, the structure of the soul is fundamentally the same. So she's not arguing that we've got different classes of people here. They're both the same. But the manner in which they undertake and relate to both the created world and to the sort of enter their creator through spiritual development is going to be slightly analogous in asymmetry, but also with some similarities. So I will stop there. She actually goes on to just talk about the structure of the soul in that sense, which is also interesting. But I'm going to stop there because I think we're out of time. And you've been very patient. Blinded by controversy.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
You're welcome.
I'm a great fan of Nina's style.
Great.
But when I read her essays on women, in particular this, the principles of women's education, I didn't get the sense of what her curriculum was, or did she actually have one, and is it available? Did people follow her to develop it?
No, this is really great. This is like when people ask me to give practical things, you know, when I now and then when I give talks on things that are practical, I write a whole bunch of stuff down and I look at it and I go, well, this isn't very practical, but I thought it was practical. And then sometimes I write stuff down and say, this is preliminary and here's the practical stuff. And then I look at the practical part and I'm like, well, these are still principles. They're not practical at all. I think she struggled with practical stuff, actually. I think she was really sort of a philosopher. She has a few notes in a few places, but yeah, you'd never actually get to sort of the real specifics of the curriculum. It's a little bit of a teaser. I mean, you know, with Edith, I think, with a few others of her stature, you know, you have the sense that she was robbed of finishing her great, you know, some of her work. But we just have notes. We just have notes. Now, I will say this. Curricula in Germany, even in religious schools at that time, were fairly, they were fairly systematic. And it would be possible to go back and look at what they looked like. So she comments mostly in that essay on ways in which it should be different from what already exists. So it would probably be possible to back out through induction something like what it probably looks like. You know, so yeah. So I would agree with you. It's not exactly a ready curriculum. But there's a lot of stuff in there. Yeah. Yeah,
how do you think that Edith Stein would respond to kind of like socialization theory that is present in modern feminism?
Can you just help me out?
Oh, sure. So the idea that you use the example of younger boys using their bodies as tools.
Yes.
That evolves because boys are allowed to have permission to use their bodies.
Okay, so like these gender differences or cultural contexts, that sort of thing. How would she respond to it? She would have said, and she did say, that that both things are true. That's what she did. And she did say that more than one place. What she thought, though, is that kind of thing that you're thinking of as socialization is itself caused by something. And she said, we don't have good reasons to suspect that the causal impetus behind certain kinds of traditions in society, that causal impetus is just all wrong, right? So because for her, the original language of the Jewish scriptures, I mean, this is all correct. So she thinks this is all the revelation of God. So the kinds of things that contemporary feminists would say were suspect in the development of these various traditions. But then she's highly rational. So then she walks into different things and says, well, you know, she says, for instance, well, obviously, given that women tend toward wanting to do things like taking care of people, they're going to make really great nurses and doctors and teachers. But then she says, but does that mean that they wouldn't be good in kind of scientific settings? And then she says, well, no, actually, there are a bunch of types of women. Remember the third category? She says, there's a bunch of types of women that make really great scientists because of these three things. So she would have said a little bit of both in some sense, which is, like, if you have a tradition which is irrational, which is that women don't do science because we don't teach women science because they're not supposed to be scientists, she would say, well, that's silly, you know. And she was in a male field and spent most of her time with accomplished men. So, and she frequently said no particular profession or thing should be barred to women. Think about the one about men using their bodies in that way. That's what she would say. Did you have a question as well?
Yeah, I have a very, what could seem like a mundane question.
No.
But I was just curious if you had any insight as to why we tend to refer to Edith Stein as Edith Stein and not St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, apart from the fact that that's cumbersome.
Yeah.
I'm sure we could shorten it.
Yeah.
But I even just feel awkward knowing that she's a canonized saint, saying Edith Stein. It's just kind of, you know, you refer to someone with their highest kind of honor. She was essentially very successful at life, and we recognize that. And the church has made us aware of this so that we can ask for intercession, various things.
Right.
I can imagine various reasons, but I'd like your insight as to why we tend to stick with her name prior to her.
Yeah. Well, I don't concede that it's a mundane question, but I will give you sort of a mundane answer, which is that I think in these matters, like, human affection matters a lot. And, you know, she has a beautiful and interesting and compelling story, and she wrote many things under the name of Edith Stein. And to get to know her as a young woman and as a kind of a developing philosopher is to get to know the work of Edith Stein. It's not the work of the later Carmelite, you know what I mean? So I would want to say that this is just the tendency of kind of human affections, you know? So when I got to know her thought, I was reading the writings of Edith Stein. So then as I grow and then come to understand her spiritual depth later as a saint, it doesn't kind of cancel it out, but it doesn't, but my affection for her origin in some sense is not, yeah. Like, I think it would require a kind of unnatural obliteration of a natural human affection, right? She's a young woman who was born in Germany in a particular time in a particular family and was a really compelling, interesting person. And we, at least I do, have natural affection for that. And it would be unnatural to me to wrestle that away and kind of like, well, I know that she has this higher, without taking anything away from that higher canonization. But I think that that's the reason.
Thank you so much. Can you say something about her Christology, and in particular, does she think Christ has an essentially masculine soul in her categories? And if so, and if there's this really important difference between masculine and feminine souls, such that they're indeed separate species, does that mean that there's some kind of problem for women in the imitation of Christ, and the imitatio Christi, if he has an essentially masculine soul? Something in that space.
Yeah, so she doesn't get into that particular problematic, she does think that Jesus Christ as a human male was deeply masculine in this way. I want to remind you of that third category, right?
Yeah.
So that for her, that third category is individual personality. So when we're thinking about the person of God becoming a man, it's certainly possible for us to imagine that within the richness of his divine person, right, all those unique characteristics, right? When I meet a man who, say, has qualities of warmth that Edith would have said, well, that's a feminine quality generally, is it that kind of warmth or that expansiveness, or I don't tend to say, well, what I just met a feminine man, right? I just think, well, I just met a man who's very warm, right? This is the way I think about it. So I think it would be possible for us to imagine that the person of Jesus Christ, being the divine personality, kind of had all, you know, would have possessed all of the wonderful and desirable features that we can imagine in perfected humanity, even many of the most important feminine characteristics as well, and I imagine that he did. But we wouldn't say that was like a feminine Jesus. in terms of the difficulty of imitating Christ, I mean, I don't think this is difficult for her. She spends a lot of time on Mariology and the way in which the church is the bride of Christ, and so I think she would have said, you know, it's no problem that women are the spouse of Christ, right? So for her, once you have the spousal union, it's, you know, kind of done. So, but it's a good question. When she says that they're distinct species, you know, it's a philosophical category. I don't think she's gonna, you know, she's gonna die on that field, I don't think. Yeah. But I think she had a pretty, you know, she really did have a pretty expansive idea of the way in which we could be individually, in some ways, individually better than our particular gender, if that makes any sense. I think that, because I think she thought that she was. Well, you know, maybe that better than her gender, but she, I mean, she, yeah. You, like, it's like you can't read through this without realizing that she identified in some ways with her male colleagues much more than with her, like her sisters at home and her mother and so on. I mean, not in a dysfunctional way, but in the way that many people kind of wake up and they go, well, that's funny, I do this, but, you know, mostly men do that, you know, okay. Okay, so, yeah. All right. Yes?
Yeah. Your background in economics
yeah.
has sort of intersections with this kind of
yeah.
In a more sociological area. I'm wondering, do you sort of look at that and think of Edith as being prophetic in some degree, or are there particular things that she saw as like going off the path of masculinity or femininity that are, you think, particularly prevalent or relevant in our culture?
Well, yeah, somewhere I wrote some practical things down about this. I think Erica remembers that. But so that was a lot of questions you asked, and I want to be very brief to let people go. But so first off, she's absolutely prophetic. I mean, this point about the double shift or the second shift that women have, she highlights in this description of kind of like the women that are trying to balance everything and they're like they're irritated and nervous and running around everywhere. You know, you're like, this was written yesterday. You know, it's pretty great. But then her main practical advice, if we had to skip ahead, and you asked about social science, which I'll get to in a minute. Her main practical advice for women was that, you know, if you were going about your business and you weren't making time for spiritual things, that you were going to become that nervous, irritated, like frazzled person that we just described. So she thought that that was sort of the best practical thing she could say. And she had some other things too, but mostly, I mean, that would be her big thing. A lot of what she wrote about men and women and their specific proclivities is certainly kind of foreshadows a certain wave of the self-help books on kind of related to the sort of men are from Mars, women are from Venus stuff, which is probably before most of you are born at this point. But there was a kind of wave of stuff, which is now actually kind of passé, that was kind of about, like, if we get really down there and we look at the data on how men and women are different and they function different, we could kind of make better sense out of our marriages. You know, he doesn't really dislike you, he just needs his alone time, or, you know, this sort of thing. It was like all this stuff. And a lot of what she said, because she, so the baseline impulse of the phenomenological tradition that she belonged to was and is deeply psychological. So they spend a lot of time thinking about the fundamental psychological experience. So you can find lots and lots of stuff in there that I think kind of prefigures that trend, which is to sort of, what can we do better? What can we learn by understanding men and women differently? Like, we could gain something from that. So I think she's sort of, separately, I think there are a lot of interesting ideas in her thought that could be tested in the language and methods of contemporary social science, but most of which haven't been, and that would form a really interesting research agenda for someone. maybe someone here. So, yeah.
I think that might be all we have time for. Thank you for joining us.